The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
At a little after 9 a.m. on Friday, November 8, 1985, in West Harris County, just 2 miles north of small town Katy, Texas, a couple rice farmers on their way to harvest the day's crops noticed black smoke billowing high into the air. In their vehicle, they followed the smoke to its source and discovered a car smoldering from what had obviously been a terrible fire not long before. The men sped away to call police. Authorities and firefighters arrived quickly, but weren't prepared for what they found. Inside the smoldering vehicle, in the front passenger's seat, was a body. The body, of course, was charred. It was so charred, in fact, so disfigured from the blaze, that Harris County Sheriff's deputies couldn't tell if the body was male or female. Identifying these remains wasn't going to be an easy task, but at least they could identify who the car belonged to. Later that afternoon, sheriff's investigators did just that, and the vehicle, a 1984 Jaguar, was registered to a familiar name, 52-year-old millionaire oilman Edward Gerald Baker, known to most as simply Ed. The Houston police and the Harris County Sheriff's Department, in fact, had been on the lookout for this very car since the day before, Thursday, November 7, 1985. At 9:15 that morning, Ed and his wife Sandy Baker's gardener saw that a window of their Northwest Houston home was broken, and inside were signs of what looked like a burglary at first sight. In Ed and Sandy's bedroom, on the floor, was an overturned ashtray and a telephone, which had been knocked off a bedside table. Upon inspection of the rest of the home, however, a burglary or robbery began to appear far less likely. Nothing else was in disarray, let alone ransacked in any way. Ed Baker's jacket laid across a chair in the living room, and in it, credit cards and $900 cash. The only things that seemed to be missing was a shotgun, Ed's 1984 Jaguar, and Ed himself. His wife Sandy reported him missing after he failed to show up at the office. These were far from the only signs that something was terribly wrong before Ed Baker's car was found smoldering 13 miles west of his home. And to this day, exactly what happened to oilman Ed Baker is shrouded in mystery. Edward Gerald Baker, or Ed, was born to parents Cecil and Pearl Baker in Polk County, Florida, on August 16, 1933. Ed's mother was a homemaker and his father was an auto mechanic. They were a working-class family who did well enough to get by. When Ed became working age and into his young adulthood, he took whatever jobs he could to earn some scratch. And, it seems, he learned early on that his talents were best suited for sales. Ed Baker worked as a shoe salesman, peddled various goods for the department store Montgomery Ward, and eventually landed a job as an insurance agent, a job he'd hold for years to come. In 1953, when he was 20 years old and living in Austin, Texas, Ed married 17-year-old Sally Catherine Mercer. They had all the ups and downs that you'd expect from any young couple, but they overcame those obstacles and did well together. Ed and Sally, anyway, weren't alone in the struggles of marriage. The two also had 2 daughters and 1 son. The family, at some point, ended up in Corpus Christi, Texas. A little over 20 years after Ed and Sally were married, tragedy befell the family. The day after Thanksgiving, 1973, on Friday, November 24th, Sally and she and Ed's boy Blake were on a 2-lane highway traveling back home after visiting family in Austin. They made it about 8 miles south of Luling when a deer bolted from the woods into the road. Sally swerved to avoid hitting the animal, and as she did, she lost control, skidding sideways into an oncoming vehicle. 11-year-old Blake survived the accident with minor injuries, luckily, as did the driver and passenger of the other car. But Sally Baker died of her injuries at a San Antonio hospital where she'd been rushed after the crash. She was only 37 years old. 3.5 months after the tragic accidental death of his wife Sally, on March 16, 1974, Ed Baker married Mary Ella Walker. 4 years after that, in 1978, the couple founded Vanguard Groups International. The company, which was among the fastest-growing businesses in the United States, built affordable housing at first and transitioned into selling commercial real estate partnerships by 1980. The company was doing well, but it was 1981 when things really took off. In 1980, while dealing primarily in commercial real estate, Ed Baker began dabbling in the promotion of oil well exploration, leading to Vanguard Groups International's transition yet again into the sales of limited partnerships in potential and speculative oil wells. The oil extraction and production business was booming in Houston in the early 1980s, largely due to America's high demand and Texas's ability to supply it after political and social instability throughout many other oil-producing countries of the Middle East in the 1960s and 1970s. Gas prices were sky high, which greatly benefited Texas Petroleum fat cats. Ed Baker saw an opportunity to be one of those oil men. Ed was smart and even smarter at selling himself. Like him, investors saw opportunity in Texas oil production, and when many of his first speculative oil wells paid off, Ed got clout. Folks started to trust him, and investments poured in. These investments, too, were tax shelters, havens to legally keep assets while minimalizing capital gains taxes. By 1982, Vanguard Groups International's sales boomed to almost $20 million. The following year, it was reported that the company was Houston's sixth fastest growing private firm, having grown 1,324% since its second year of operation. Ed Baker, who came from a modest working-class family who relied on an auto mechanic's paycheck, was a millionaire. And he'd gotten there virtually overnight with the help of his second wife, Mary, of course. The money, however, went to his head a little, and Ed Baker's determination to maintain the lifestyle he wished to accompany his business's success might have cost the man his life. Most of us have guilty pleasures. I know I do. Bad horror movies top that list for me, followed closely by old sensationalistic detective magazines. I don't feel bad at all, however, about my love for the amazing mobile game Best Fiends. It's a match 3 puzzle game with thousands of levels that's impossible to put down. I certainly can't. And my standing at level 3194 is proof of that. It's been over a year since I started playing Best Fiends, and my little army of bugs and other cool creatures is upgraded nicely and ready to salt some sinister slugs. Best Fiends is boredom's worst nightmare, since the game updates regularly with more levels, challenges, and new events. Best Fiends has over 100 million downloads for a reason. I play when I'm bored or I knock out a few levels on coffee breaks at work. Sometimes I use the game to take my mind out of all the dark places this podcast takes me. There are currently over 5,000 levels available, so you can even binge play. And I know y'all like to binge. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Ed Baker went from regular guy to mega-rich oilman in a matter of just a couple years when his business took off, and having a ton of cash was completely new to him. Ed spent millions building a headquarters for his company Vanguard Groups International, a good hunk of which was spent on his own private bathroom made almost entirely of black marble. Ed was now middle-aged, and all that cash seemed to have him wanting to relive the glory days, but as a rich guy. He was a good man, most everyone thought the world of him, but becoming an overnight millionaire had an effect on what was his usually reasonable and down-to-earth character. In March of 1984, Ed divorced his second wife, Mary. He began taking disco lessons, bought a brand new luxury sports car, a Jaguar, and picked up what some called a high-stakes gambling habit. Ed even got a couple facelifts. Indulging himself with these new habits and luxuries wasn't cheap, and Ed's alimony payments weren't anything to scoff at. He was to pay Mary $8,000 a month for 10 years. That, along with the $34,000 worth of car notes and the nearly $100,000 mortgage on his home, was a substantial amount of money coming out every month. In September of 1984, just a few months after divorcing Mary, Ed Baker married a woman named Karen Walbridge in Las Vegas, Nevada. But he sought to have the marriage annulled just 2 weeks later, stating that he was drunk when they tied the knot, something that Karen disputes. But anyway, Karen and Ed were close friends since she was in charge of his company's construction division called Walbridge Construction Company. Karen talked Ed into giving the marriage some time to see if it stuck, and he agreed. It did stick for about 6 months. Ed then went through with the dissolution of marriage in March of 1985. That divorce cost Ed another $3,100 a month in alimony payments, adding to his mounting debt. Karen Walbridge, too, kept Walbridge Construction Company in the divorce settlement. But Ed's company finished out the year 1984 as Inc. magazine's 137th fastest-growing private firm. That was down from the previous year's place at number 45, but still well in the running. Like in the case of his second wife, Mary, Ed Baker and Karen remained close and didn't let the divorce ruin the friendship they had. 4 days after Karen and Ed's divorce finalized, though, in April 1985, he married a Vanguard Group International employee, Sandra Hoff, who was in her early 40s, his fourth wife. No matter, Ed Baker's world was falling apart in 1985, or so it seemed. It's reported that Ed was spending more money than he had on his extravagant lifestyle, and he'd been using investors' money to live that life, while using other investors' money to pay back the funds he was dipping into. His double dipping into investor funds to support his lavish tastes had landed him in hot water. Clients were filing lawsuits alleging that Vanguard Groups International wasn't drilling the oil wells they'd paid Ed Baker to drill. And Ed's lawyer, Ward Busey, warned him that he was looking at serious jail time if he didn't get his act together. Busey cited tax problems too, though the exact nature of those he didn't expound upon. Anyway, Ed Baker was looking for a way out, and was supposedly working on a deal with an illegitimate source to smooth things over with his up-and-up investors. When he borrowed what he called many millions in the fall of 1985, Ed went straight to his private investigator, Bob Gale, and asked him to run background checks on the men. Ed Baker had been using the services of Bob Gale for years to check out potential investors, among other business dealings and activities, and to look into extortion attempts made against him, once from someone the PI called a close female companion. Bob Gale did check out the source of Ed Baker's borrowed money, though he never disclosed exactly what he found. Here's what the private eye implied. Ed had found some shady-seeming folks from Miami, Florida, who could benefit from storing a little money in Vanguard Groups International, but this was to be considered more of a loan. And when Ed told the private investigator that he heard that they were tied to the mafia, his character and mannerisms changed. Ed Baker, it appeared, was a nervous wreck. Everything seemed to be crumbling down around him. In late October 1985, Ed's third wife, Karen, got a letter from him at her Florida home telling her that Vanguard Groups International was struggling and he wouldn't be able to pay the $3,100 a month he owed her for alimony. But, Ed Baker went on in the letter without detail, a deal was going down the following Monday, which was November 4th, 1985. And he was expecting to come into a substantial amount of money that would get the company back on track. Karen had seen Ed's state of mind grow more and more paranoid over the past months, she later said, in a series of letters he'd written her. Though he left out the specifics of exactly who, Ed Baker told Karen Walbridge of threats made against his life. The day following, when Ed was supposed to have made the big deal he'd written Karen about the previous week, Tuesday, November 5th, 1985, another event took place as Ed Baker's seeming nervousness and paranoia continued to snowball. On that day, Ed Baker's wife Sandy showed up at his daughter's house in Austin. Ed had sent her, Sandy said, because he feared her life was in danger if she stayed. Ed told Sandy, according to her, that if he dies, and he just might, that she'd hurt at first, but she should be strong, and eventually she'd be okay. On Wednesday, November 6th, Ed called Karen Walbridge, his third wife, at her home in Florida, and a friend who was house-sitting answered the phone. Karen, the friend told Ed, was out of town. He told the friend to tell her that he called and nothing else. At 7:30 p.m. that day, Ed Baker showed up unannounced at the home of his second wife, Mary, the wife who'd helped him create Vanguard Groups International. He was nervous and jittery. His distressed emotional state was the result, Ed told Mary, of the letters he'd been receiving over the past 2 weeks that threatened his life. And, Ed went on, it wasn't just letters. While at home, he claimed to have received 2 threatening phone calls.
"This is your day to die,"
Ed Baker told Mary, the caller said on both. Ed's home phone number was unlisted. Mary didn't know what to do. She'd later say that she'd never seen Ed so distraught and paranoid. It wasn't like him at all. His complexion, Mary said, was ghost white. She told Ed he had to call the police. She begged him to, but he refused. They wouldn't be able to help him, Ed told Mary. He left. Earlier that day, Ed Baker had changed his life insurance policies. Now, in the event of his death, Vanguard Groups International would no longer be the beneficiary of the life insurance payout, and instead, his estate, worth $1.75 million, would go to his family. Ed Baker, it seemed, knew he was going to die. Several hours after leaving Mary's house, now Thursday, November 7th, 1985, at about 1 a.m., Ed phoned his wife Sandy, who he'd sent to his daughter's house in Austin. He'd just received another call to his unlisted number, threatening his life, he told her, and was locked up in their bedroom. That was the last known time anyone ever spoke to Ed Baker. After a series of incidents displaying the paranoid and emotionally distressed state of mind that 52-year-old oilman Ed Baker seemed to be in, including letters to his ex-wife in Florida speaking of threats made to his life, sending his wife Sandy to stay at his daughter's in Austin, and changing his life insurance policy so that his family would benefit as opposed to his company, he disappeared. On the morning of Thursday, November 7th, 1985, Ed and Sandy Baker's gardener noticed a broken window at their home. At around 9:15 a.m., Sandy called the Harris County Sheriff's Office to report Ed missing after getting word he didn't show up for work. A Be on the Lookout was issued for Ed's 1984 Jaguar. The next day, Friday, November 8, 1985, rice farmers out harvesting crops just north of Katy, Texas, saw black smoke coming from one of the fields, and upon following the billow, found that a terribly burnt, smoldering car was its source. When Harris County Sheriff's deputies arrived, they discovered inside the vehicle a human body. A human body so charred and disfigured from the fire that identifying whether it belonged to a male or female was impossible without the medical examiner. The car, however, was identified as millionaire oilman Ed Baker's 1984 Jaguar relatively fast, leading investigators to believe that the body inside was the vehicle's owner, though the fact that the body was in the passenger seat was strange. Also inside the vehicle was a ring, later confirmed to belong to Ed Baker. But mysteriously, it wasn't melted by the extreme temperatures of the fire. The same harsh blaze that had so badly burned a human body, it couldn't be identified as male or female. Remnants of a shotgun, which had burned and melted, were inside the car too, as was Ed's side pistol that he regularly carried, a .32 caliber Smith & Wesson, at his feet in the floorboard. Three cans of accelerant, described by some reports as 3 1-gallon gasoline cans, were found in and around the burnt car. Later, an eyewitness came forward claiming to have seen a pickup truck speeding away from the scene of Ed Baker's burning car at around 6:30 a.m., a couple hours before its discovery. A blue Chevrolet pickup with chrome rails and mag wheels. Later that day, the Harris County Sheriff's Office sent a wrecker out to remove the car from the rice field. Smoke no longer billowed from Ed Baker's 1984 Jaguar, so the wrecker driver was having a little trouble locating it when he arrived at the North Katy rice fields to tow the car away at around 5 p.m. When he came about 100 yards from the vehicle, the wrecker driver discovered something he wasn't sent out there to find. The body of a young man in his early 20s, wearing only a camouflage print t-shirt. The young man's hands were bound behind his back with handcuffs. The wrecker driver, of course, radioed Harris County Sheriff's deputies, who sped to the scene. They discovered a pair of overalls not far from the young man's body that seemed to belong to him, and the terrible fate he'd met was obvious even without moving the body an inch. His skull was crushed from multiple high-impact blows to the head with a blunt object. Harris County Sheriff's Office homicide detective Ronnie Phillips later commented that the young man appeared to be a construction worker, judging by his calloused hands and teeth that appeared to have bitten nails, holding them for quick access while building. The body was a confusing discovery, and detectives didn't know what to make of it. They weren't sure if there was a connection to Ed Baker's fire-ravaged car and the body inside, and if there was, it was hard to theorize just what that connection might be. Later, Harris County authorities discovered that Ed Baker's lawyer, Ward Busey, received a letter that very same day. It read,
"Dear Ward, if you're reading this letter, it means that I am dead. I've had some threats on my life, and you've been a good friend to me. Please take care of Sandy and the kids and do what you can for them. And enclosed is another letter that I would like you to take out to Sandy and give to her for me."
Friday, November 8, 1985, was a tragically eventful day, and it wasn't over. That night, Ed Baker's son, 23-year-old Blake Baker, showed up at Ed and Sandy's home in North Houston. Sandy had since returned from Austin, where Ed had sent her days earlier, so she'd be safe, he told her. Anyway, Blake was drunk and apparently became belligerent. It's unclear exactly what went down between Blake and Sandy that night, but after the two began talking about Ed Baker's estate and where the inheritance would go, Blake blew up, pointing out that his father might not even be dead. The body in the car hadn't been identified. He demanded that Sandy, his stepmother, give him $200,000. And as the argument grew more and more heated, Sandy ordered him from the home, called police, and had him arrested for being drunk and for disorderly conduct. It's hard to know what to make of this event, but it's hardly the last of Blake's erratic behavior. On Saturday, November 9th, 1985, a crowd gathered at the home of Ed and Sandy Baker. Family, friends, and neighbors came to offer Sandy their support as she waited for the identification of the charred body found in Ed's Jaguar. Those who knew him well, family and friends, shared memories and spoke of his good nature and intelligence. His stepdaughter somberly spoke of what a wonderful man Ed was. The family was presuming that the body inside the burnt Jaguar was Ed's. Neighbors who didn't know Ed all that well still knew of his friendliness. It was apparent in the smile and wave he always gave in passing. No identification, however, was made that day, not of the charred remains found in the smoldering car, and not of the 20-something-year-old man found nearly naked, bound, and beaten to death only 300 feet away. At some point in the 24-hour period after his arrest, Ed Baker's son Blake posted bond after being taken into custody for drunk and disorderly charges. He called his stepmother Sandy almost immediately, it seems, and asked to see her so they could talk. Sandy absolutely refused. Blake again became belligerent. Well, a bit beyond belligerent. Apparently, Blake Baker again demanded $200,000 and told his stepmother if she didn't give it to him, he'd kill her and her daughter.
"You're dead,"
he told Sandy before abruptly hanging up. Blake wasn't aware, however, of Sandy's hiring of private detective Clyde Wilson and the recording device he'd put on the Baker resident's phone. Since Ed Baker's insistence that she go to his daughter's house in Austin to avoid danger and the subsequent discovery of his smoldering car and the charred body within, Sandy had hired Clyde Wilson not only for protection, but also to investigate what looked to be Ed's death. Blake was caught red-handed on recording and was arrested and charged with making terroristic threats. He was back in county jail almost as soon as he stepped foot out of it. As the Harris County Sheriff's Office began their investigation into the charred body found in Ed Baker's smoldering car, they proceeded as if that body was indeed Ed's. Homicide Detective Ronnie Phillips told reporters for the Houston Chronicle that the department had gotten word that Ed might have received a loan from individuals associated with organized crime. Presumably, this information came from Ed's wife Sandy, who later claimed that mafia figures in Miami killed her husband because he owed them $1 million. The claim had at least some merit. There was a Florida connection. Ed's ex-wife, Karen, with whom he still spoke to and was friendly with, lived in Florida. Organized crime in Florida, and particularly Miami, was still prevalent and pervasive in the 1980s. Ed's nervousness and paranoia in the weeks leading up to his car going up in flames had all the signs of a man who was into something or someone way over his head. Ed had told plenty of folks, his wife and ex-wives, that he'd received death threats. Even Ed Baker's private investigator, Bob Gale, alluded to these threats. When asked if Ed had ever mentioned his life being threatened, Gale said, quote,
"No, not exactly. I had to read between the lines,"
end quote. Vanguard Groups International, Ed's company, was in trouble. He'd been using the assets of new investors to pay the money he owed the old ones. Ed's gambling habit had become a problem. At least one close family member commented that Ed Baker was always placing bets, and just as often losing thousands of dollars at a time. He flew to Lake Tahoe and Las Vegas, Nevada all the time to engage in high-stakes games. Ed's ex-wife, Karen, saw him gambling at a Lake Tahoe casino the week before he disappeared, she said. Private investigator Bob Gale said that if he needed to talk to Ed on the weekends, he knew to call Las Vegas. In fact, Gale went on to say, when Vanguard's troubles began, Ed's gambling increased tenfold. He was trying to hit it big so he could save the company, Gale said. When Ed Baker disappeared, it's been reported, he owed over $50,000 to a few casinos in Vegas. However, Ed's attorney of almost a decade, Ward Busey, scoffed at the allegations that Ed was a high-stakes gambler. Ed Baker, Busey said, placed $20 to $30 bets at the roulette wheel, hardly enough to consider the oil man a high roller. Busey went on to say that owing $50,000 to three casinos isn't a huge deal by Vegas standards. To put that into perspective, that's over $120,000 in 2021 money. Seems like a big deal to me, but what do I know? The only gambling I ever do is quarter poker. Still, detectives for the Harris County Sheriff's Office weren't convinced yet that Ed Baker disappeared or died as the result of a gambling debt, or even a loan taken out from an organized crime source to satiate the lawsuits from investors wanting a return, or at the very least, their money back. They didn't even have an identification of the charred body found in the oilman's car. The twists and turns the investigation to come took seemed to have no end. We'll pick it back up from here next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information about Edward Gerald Baker's case, please contact Crime Stoppers Houston at 713-222-8477. We'd like to extend a huge thank you to our good pal Steve Owens of Fascination Street Podcast for lending us his voice this episode. If you're not listening to Fascination Street, you should be. Steve interviews some of the most interesting folks around, including, for all you true crime fans, DNA superhero scientist David Middleman of Othram Incorporated, the company solving cold cases and identifying Jane Does left and right. It's an incredible interview. David is a passionate guy fighting the good fight. Thanks to Othram, as most of y'all listening know, an arrest and indictment was made in Carla Walker's murder. Also, Steve has interviewed Carol Baskin of Tiger King fame, and the amazingly talented and smooth-voiced Lainey from the podcast True Crime Fan Club, one of my favorite interviews on Fascination Street. Check it out, y'all. We'll put a link in the show notes. And speaking of David Middleman and Othram Incorporated, if you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company like Ancestry or 23andMe to their database. We'll provide a link to DNASolves.com in the show notes. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Desert Killer and the Odessa Lust murders, to name a few. I've got an interesting one coming up soon about a psychopath with a strange connection to a member of the Manson family. Anyway, thanks to everyone who supports us there. It means the world to Erica and I, and we couldn't do this without you. Inc. Magazine, the Miami Herald, the Houston Chronicle, and the television show Unsolved Mysteries were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.